Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com. Hello and welcome to Weird Things. My name is Justin Robert Young. Andrew Main is on assignment this week, but joining me, as always, referred to in the paranormal and scientific communities as the Jim Norton of this show, Brian Brushwood.
Oh, thank goodness. Hi, it's such a pleasure to be a guest yet again on the Weird Things podcast, Justin. Thank you so much.
And filling in, because this has to be a three-man weave or else it's just Night Attack, is Bryce Neshcom Castillo. Welcome back to the program, Bryce.
Hey, guys. I'm glad to be the donut of Weird Things.
Wait, what's the donut? Is donut a character?
I sit in the trunk, and you pull me out when you need me.
Okay.
And I can't be on for very long.
Otherwise,
it breaks your entire car.
It's putting you at serious physical risk because your constitution is only so much.
Right.
All right. Can we talk about something that I meant to talk about in a previous episode, but we never got to? It was some of the most, like, gut-punching news I had read, and it was one of those things that it's like, on the one hand, like, you know, sure, of course, advances in surprising areas, but it's fascinating to me because I wonder, and I don't want to get us too political here, but there are different political bents to have if you're more environmental or less environmental and so on. And I want to see this through as many different lenses as possible. But last week, there was an article that came out announcing that mealworms, specifically the bacteria that live inside mealworms, these are the same dried mealworms that my mom uses to feed her chickens. By the way, pro tip, my mom has chickens, a couple of hens running around the yard she throws dried mealworms to. Mealworms can eat polystyrene foam. They can eat styrofoam, and they poop out perfectly good soil, and that's thanks to the bacteria in their guts. And as I understand it, that you know, science, of course, the first thing they do is say, well, how do we eliminate the jobs of these mealworms and just get our hands on that powerful gut bacteria, and then we can use it to clean up, like, I don't know, the giant Texas-sized island of plastic waste out there. Maybe we could get it to eat hard ABS plastic and landfills and all this stuff. Like, to me,
let's just real quick before you draw the larger thing here, just to make clear for everybody, the big issue is that styrofoam popularly is thought to be non-biodegradable, and so once it is created, much like the one true ring, it cannot be unmade.
Correct. Well, and specifically, what it really means is that when you buy a Diet Coke for $1.07 at McDonald's, what you're really buying is $1.07 plus the emotional guilt of knowing that you're adding to the eternal landfills of forever with your polystyrene, cheaply generated, disposable, one-time-use cup. Mm-hmm. However, all of a sudden, the entire economy of guilt has been thrown asunder, Justin.
Well, theoretically, right? So these items, I feel like, you know, especially the ones that sort of become viral very often in our newsworthy currents kind of find the propulsion based on sort of like these ideas. The impossible is now possible. Thanks, science. And I'm curious to see more of how this is done, but it would not shock me if in 2 weeks it's like, we got it wrong.
Well,
sorry.
Exactly. So there are two sides of the coin. On the one side of the coin is like, oh, that's science, always solving the impossible. And then the other story is, damn you, science. It's been 20 whole minutes. Why haven't you solved this? You're good for nothing. You're full of lies, science.
Especially because we extrapolate stuff from this. Like, if you took, you know, mealworms eat styrofoam, you would think, okay, great, just throw them there and they'll do it. But, like, it's pretty inefficient for mealworms to eat styrofoam.
Sure.
And create soil.
Well,
that's the idea, is that now it's like, okay, well, if this is occurring in natural phenomenon, let's isolate exactly why this happens and then mass produce it and you know, have gigantic flamethrowers of whatever acid these mealworms are producing inside their tiny little bellies.
Well, and that's actually not too far off, because I would imagine if they're able to isolate the bacteria in the guts of these mealworms, I would imagine they would be able to mass produce it in farms. They'd throw it in a backpack. You'd get a dude who would spray some purple goo all over a mountain of styrofoam and know that it would totally dissolve and that you could grow plants out of it. And again, styrofoam, I mean, structurally, it's different than plastic, but chemically, it's not so different, if I understand correctly. And then this is the part where I wish we had Andrew Main here to verify this, because now all three of us are dumb. But as I understand it...
Let's go ahead, and this is from Fusion.net, which wrote about this. New findings from Stanford researchers in collaboration with researchers in China found that mealworms can subsist on a diet of styrofoam and other forms of polystyrene. This is great news for mealworms, yada, yada, yada. Published in the Environmental Science and Technology magazine, experiment involved 100 mealworms eating a pill-sized portion of styrofoam every day. The researchers found that the worms converted half the styrofoam into carbon dioxide, same as they would any food source, and the rest was excreted within a day as, quote, biodegraded fragments that looked similar to tiny rabbit droppings.
So does this mean what's funny is I don't know how polystyrene foam is recycled, but now you have a choice, or let's say hypothetically you have a choice now. Is it more efficient to recycle it, or is it more efficient to throw it to the mealworms? And which makes me think of, that moment from Flash Gordon when they send her to the boar worms.
I think there's a lot of like realistic problems with that right now, mealworms will eat styrofoam, but they will eat any other food before it. And I don't know if mealworms can actually survive on styrofoam alone.
That's what the article
they can survive only
on styrofoam and be perfectly happy. In which case, you just throw it in a giant pit of Chick-fil-A foodstuffs. In which case, they eat up until it's Sunday, and then they take a break, just like the actual Chick-fil-A.
So here's the – is it heresy to say, hey, stop worrying about styrofoam because now we've solved it with mealworms? Does styrofoam just kind of get thrown into another of the color-coded bins that I have to sort my trash in at every Rubio's fish taco place?
I mean,
because now we can just put this in the mealworm pit?
It seems like it seems like short term that's going to be the case, but it seems like long term, especially once you isolate the actual, again, it's not the mealworms doing the important work. It's the bacteria inside their guts. And as long as we isolate that, it seems like we should be able to, just spray it on like a flamethrower, like you're saying, and just melt everything down.
But the larger implication is that and where you were going initially is that styrofoam is this kind of like man's original sin thing, right? That it's like we have found this cheap, amazing way to a lightweight way to get on with our lives in a mass production manner. And yet the terrible price we have wrought on ourselves is environmental ruin.
Well,
and now, like, does that get taken off the blacklist? Is there another in 20, 30 years? Does styrofoam have any different thoughts about it than, let's say, aluminum or something else that is harder to recycle but certainly possible?
Yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like there seems to be this weird like desire for us to have guilt about our own existence and our own success as a species. We have to figure out something to feel really bad about. And I would say even if it becomes demonstrably cheap, easy, and reliable to dispose of polystyrene through mealworms, and in fact, becomes all of a sudden like used polystyrene becomes a commodity among farmers. They're like, I need to throw it on my compost pit. I got all these mealworms. They're about to, if I don't throw more polystyrene, they're going to go dormant this season. And then
they're going to hold up my wife for $50.
Exactly. I still feel like there's going to be some kind of stigma because there's so many other things.
But how would that be any different than plastics or aluminum, which both have a necessity for special plants for us to process them. You can't deal with them just like regular trash, which you can theoretically put in a landfill and will slowly, slowly go away. You know, like that. That's essentially, it would be no different. It would just be a different plant, or they would work in that process into something else.
I guess what I'm saying is, I think environmental guilt is inherent to human life and sentient. I feel like it doesn't matter how far we move the goalposts, you know, how close to perfect, you know, perfect sustainability, whatever that means, that we achieve, I feel like we'll always feel really, really guilty about the increasingly small gap. And I mean, this is...
But I guess my question for you then is it more likely that we continue to feel guilt about styrofoam, even though that, if let's presume that this is a major breakthrough and it changes the way that we deal with it, or do we find another thing to be really guilty about, and styrofoam just becomes another element of another recyclable in the way that we have other hard to process recyclables?
I mean, I think that's what's going to happen, is we will find something else to try to improve upon. I mean, this once this process gets optimized, that's not the end of, you know, understanding our impact on the environment and on nature and the things we consume and produce.
Well, and keep in mind also,
because we have a ways to go on battery reliability. That's the new thing. As batteries, we think batteries play a part in our lives now. In 50 years, batteries are going to continue to be more and more of a way that we move stuff. And I think that, like, you know, forget styrofoam guilt. Batteries are looking at gasoline level guilt in the next the next 50 years. They're ready for the big time.
Here's the flip side that I would offer, is that there's already a number of completely disproven, absolutely 100% incorrect myths that they can even trace down to the exact article or the exact reason that we believe them, and yet they still persist. You know, not the least of which is, you know, we're coming up on 50, 60 years of believing that lemmings commit suicide in bulk, when it turns out that Walt Disney Corporation is an evil corporation that just ran them off a cliff in order to get a particular shot. You know, we are still dealing with the idea that we're experiencing a cancer epidemic, when by all measures, cancers are going down. And when they do go up, it's usually because people are finally living longer because they don't have heart disease or liver disease or so on. And all of this leads me to believe that once something gets stuck in, people are still cutting up their six-pack plastic ring holders because they saw a picture once of a goose that had its head stuck in one. You know, it's
are
like,
you not I, supposed to, is that not
yeah,
a thing anymore?
It never was a thing. It never, ever was a thing. And it's a complete waste of time, and it does absolutely nothing. Which only goes to prove my point, is like, we love sticking with these environmental archetypal myths. So it's, I think we're going to continue to feel really, really guilty about polystyrene, even as it gets totally fixed and that there are much more important things. I mean, look at the anti-vax thing, right? You got people who are not vaccinating their children because they feel slightly oogie about a completely fabricated study from 20 years ago.
Well, I think with styrofoam, there's still not, it, even if this process is perfected, it's still not a perfect product. You know, this process creates CO2, which in large scales could be harmful to the environment, as well as just the manufacturing of styrofoam could include any number of environmental issues compared to using a more holistic material, whatever that would be.
I think the bigger question, and I think the more interesting one, is, Brian, I think you're totally right that these things stick around. The question is, because there is an ebb and a flow to it, like that these things do stick around, but they're not necessarily as persistent. Like, I think that, like, now, when we were growing up, people cutting their stupid things apart were, you know, huge, especially, you know, growing up in South Florida, where, like, you could see a dolphin somewhere. You know, that was always the thing for me, was that dolphin. The poor bottlenose dolphins were getting their cute little bottlenoses stuck in these horrid Coca-Cola six-pack rings. But now I don't think that's as big of a thing. I think that there is a kind of ebb to it. And I would suspect that if this becomes more of a regular thing – that we have, you know, in the same way that we do sort out our trash, and there is compost and high density plastics and general landfill trash. If there's one more thing for styrofoam and it has a special process to it, I feel like there will be a lessening. Although I agree with you, I don't think it'll ever go away.
So here's
I mean, I agree with that, with the sentiment that the myth probably will continue on in some fashion. What is the harm in that in the large scope? Is it just the waste of time?
Yes.
Why shouldn't we live in a haunted house of fear and terror where all of our own actions are creating hobgoblins meant to rip our throats out? For dare we succeed and dominate nature?
I guess, I mean, that's the reverse of the question, right? Where it's like, is there ever, like, is there ever a scenario in which you, the folks who want to feel guilty decide, okay, we could stop feeling guilty? Like, let's say 100 years from now, biodiversity is at an all-time high. Let's say that, genetic engineering and eco-poets have put together more biomes with more biomass. We have more old growth forests than all time. I feel like in that world where by every calculable measure, people are living longer, animals live longer, there's the greatest amount of everything, I feel like people would still have an excuse to feel really bad about something. Like, ooh, we really messed up. I got to cut something up to feel better.
Well, because there is always motivation for action based on, you know, us being an empathetic society and feeling that we are causing some damage, but it's not always equal. If you look, let's say global warming, for example, if you look at methane emissions or climate harmful gases, a lot of them come out of cows' buttholes.
Actually, technically, cows. For the record, when cows fart, they fart out their mouth because they have multiple stomachs, and the gas gets released out their mouth, not the butt.
That's what I was saying, is that their butt is their mouth, which is the weirdest part about
it. Hey, welcome to Weird Things, ladies and gentlemen.
I did not know that, but they're good to know. Yeah. So they fart out their mouth. Here's the thing.
Title of the episode.
Are you ready for that's just the appetizer. But yet, when we look for climate change solutions, we look at, well, we should ramp down our industrial production instead of, we should ramp down factory creation of meats. Like, and that's not to say that one is the right solution and one isn't.
But the default answer is clearly, well, it's not like we're going to stop eating hamburgers. Come on, people. We need to shut down automobiles because automobiles look...
We make a decision. And I do believe that a lot of our decisions are at some point informed by what we believe we can control and what we believe we can affect. And that's where when you count on, like, okay, well, what makes us feel terrible? What makes us what do we feel is human's original sin? It does factor into real life solutions, because you don't see there's going to be, you know, there's a presidential election coming up. You're going to see a lot of people on both sides of the aisle talk about what they do and don't believe are solutions for climate change. And you will not see any of them say we should all go vegan and it should be mandatory. And if you get caught eating a hamburger, you're going to go to jail, because that is not something that has the propulsive momentum in terms of a meme in the way that, well, shut down your factory, sir, like does.
Right. Eating less beef is asking everyone to take it on the chin versus yelling at a building that,
or the fat cats in Washington.
Yeah. Well, a spoiler alert. Something that will surprise absolutely nobody who listens to this program. Like, I'm optimistic in our ability to, in the next 5 to 10 years, have stuff like lab grown meats. And I'll tell you what, Justin, you have been the bridge to open my eyes wide to an entire world of heavily processed foods that taste every bit as naughty as Cheetos and yet are made of kale and fake cheese. So it's like, I'm on the vegan train. I think veganism should be mandatory for all people. There, I said it.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you support our at the barrel of a gun solution for everybody to start eating vegan, then you need to go to patreon.com/weirdthings. Now, granted, if you donate to us, there will be no money that goes toward this cause. However, you will support this podcast, which brings you every single week a smattering of weirdness between me, Brian Brushwood, and normally Andrew Main. It is your contributions that make us do this show. We said this last week. I'll say it again. There was a time when Andrew saying, "Hey, I'm not going to be able to make the show," would have equaled Brian and I saying, "Good news for us.
No Sunday's show today. Off. That's just more Hearthstone for me, buddy."
And we would have, except now you guys are paying us. We have a reason to do it. Thank you guys so much. If you want to support the show, patreon.com/weirdthings. It helps go to pay for Bryce Neshcom Castillo and makes him financially obligated to come in and do the show.
Oh, yeah. And because he's obligated, it makes us obligated. And we all like being obligated.
Hey, speaking of money.
Yeah.
I got a real sweet money-making opportunity for you guys.
Oh, shoot. We're going to start our own business. I'm ready. I got funder capital. I don't know if you know, but I've been suckering all these people on a service called Patreon.com. You ever hear of it? We got like hundreds of them throwing money at us. They don't even know what I'm going to waste it on. What do you got? I'll buy anything.
What? Brian?
Yeah?
We squandered all that. All that money's gone. We don't have any money. We got to go as a band of three people. In fact, no, here, I'll put you guys in the scenario. It's you and Bryce.
Okay.
Okay.
You're out on the road.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go to a village in Zimbabwe and get them to pay you money.
Okay, listen. how much money and are there any limits on how we get this money?
Nope. You just have – here's the hot new craze. The kids call it raising money from a village, okay. And it's not what you think.
All right, listen. First of all, I did bring this entire briefcase of mealworms.
Okay.
First of all, we got to get this village addicted to polystyrene.
No.
We got to get them addicted to polystyrene, right? Sure. We open a McDonald's. Mm-hmm. We get them. They're drowning in polystyrene cups.
Yeah.
And then we're like, hey, you want these mealworms? They're super rare. It's all the money in your village. And then they pay us for it.
Okay.
No.
That's a long con.
Polystyrene's banned in this village, Brian.
Oh, okay. All right, Bryce, what do you got?
They're very it's not their jam. They prefer a more eco-friendly meal.
Jerks.
And so they have no need.
Bryce, what do you got?
Okay. So here's what we do. We start selling body parts.
Not where I thought we were headed, but I'm interested.
Yeah.
There's no bad ideas in brainstorming. Human body parts?
Whatever.
Just body parts in general.
Yeah, we start with animals, right?
We show up, we pitch a tent, and then we say, "Well, what's wrong with you here in your little village? You got a touch of the dysentery? You need a child's finger.
Yes.
Just plug it in your nose at night, and by the morning, the runs will stop.
This is no normal child's finger. This is... Annie Oakley's original baby finger.
Sure. Know? Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. No, we lie about all the body parts. So all we have to – now, these are human body parts.
Can be.
Or maybe
I think there's also room for animal parts.
We kill some monkeys and cut off their fingers and say they're baby fingers, and baby fingers cure things?
No, those are wishing machines. Monkey's paws.
Wishing machines, of course. Okay, so if we get a paw, then we do that.
Okay. So again, with the goal of this thought exercise being that you get the town to raise money to pay you for something, your solution is that you dismember animals and human beings and open a retail business where you sell body parts.
Look, Justin, I see you're trying to drive a wedge between Bryce and I. We've been business partners for years, and I'm going to stand behind my partner. If he wants to cut up some humans and or monkeys and or whoever's, then yeah, no, I'm done. I'm down.
Unless we can sell them on a concept.
Wait, okay, crazy idea. Here's my other idea.
What's up?
We put on masks. We run around at night.
Mm-hmm.
We... get some bioluminescence to scare them. We walk among the village and talk about, "Oh, did you see the old haunted woods were alive last night?" And we spin the tale of the
all right, wait, hold on.
And then anti-haunting monkey paws.
You're You're sitting out at the local watering hole.
Yep.
I need you as you're the con man. You're kind of you got some grass stains maybe on your on your jeans that you're trying to downplay because now it's the next day. There's been a haunting in the town.
Well,
what is your pitch?
For the record, what I do have grass stains on me, but like I've taken rubber cement and I've rubbed it all over my face so that as it dries, it makes it all wrinkly, so I look like an old man, and I kind of walk hunched over with my grass stained knees. Bryce, meanwhile, in our two man con job, is the young kid in town who's always full of fire and vinegar. I'm the one who sits on the porch of the local watering hole, where they unfortunately only sell water, but I drink as though it's whiskey. And I was like, oh, ain't nothing like a cool drink of water after a long day of work dealing with the forces of darkness. Am I right, boys?
You guys heard of this haunting, right? We need to do something about this.
No, there ain't no such thing as a haunting.
I've seen lights.
Out
in the woods.
I cleaned up all of that, and I thought you and I talked about this. Yeah, we don't need to trouble their heads about any haunting.
Look, I'm just saying, you get a haunting, you got to do it right. You got to clean it out right. You know, I think your solution will be fine for
Bryce. Listen, these are pagan, non-God fearing folks over here. They don't want to hear about your hauntings. They're trying to pay the bills. If you understand what I'm saying, it's not like they can buy our special brand of pig's blood in order to keep away the haunting. I say, just let the science resolve itself. I say there's a debate going on about whether or not there's a haunting around this village. I say let the scientists conclude the debate, and we don't need to involve ourselves in there.
Well, if...
All right, so that goes to that night. That night, you guys are out trying to perpetuate your con. How do you sell that this is a worsening crisis? Like, what do you do to the town?
First of all, what we do is we say that...
need to be victims, I think.
No.
Not too soon? Day two? Too soon for victims?
What the hell, Bryce? Your two ideas are selling human body parts and injuring people so there are victims.
I mean, it seems like what we do is we shine some lights. We rub ourselves in bioluminescent paint, and we flop around... And then we say,
"You're doing the worm."
Yeah, exactly. We do the worm, and we say, "Teach the debate, teach the debate. Are we real?" And then we get people talking. We just want them talking about whether or not they're about to be killed by.
We leave bumper stickers. Yes. That say, teach the debate.
Yes.
And it's all right. So it's the next day. Your bioluminescent breakdancing has certainly brought the town to a buzz. They're all whispering to each other. Teach the debate. Teach the debate. Did you hear? Teach the debate. Now, all right. This is your big pitch. This is the big sell.
Yeah.
Now you're back at the watering hole. You guys go ahead and a villager comes up.
Hey, mister! Did you see the breakdancing aliens? Should we teach the debate?
Well, I don't know if teaching the debate will make a lick of difference one way or the other, but the one thing I do know is that these mealworms have never not once been party to a global apocalypse. I can guarantee you that they were all gathered from villages all across this land, and not one of them have been taken over by ghost breakdancing aliens.
Well, I think the science on this is totally sound. In fact, I would like to buy a couple of your mealworms.
All right, the science is not settled. Let's you and me have words about that, sir.
Yeah.
I think we're all fine and we don't need those. Although, if somebody were to go ahead and get one, I suppose I wouldn't fault them. Better safe than sorry. But I think we're just fine without them.
Well,
Wait a minute, say all the villagers at once. Here's $400. We'll take all the mealworms you have. Congratulations, guys.
I mean, it's against
my... You totally won this thought exercise. Period. End of paragraph. On a totally different note, a resident in a Zimbabwe town have raised $400 to keep goblins away.
To keep goblins away? This is the part where is the part where all of a sudden Bryce and I need alibis to prove that we weren't in Zimbabwe last week.
I swear we were 5 feet tall.
and listen, we'll read this, and of course the caveat on all the goblin stories is that these are probably going to be actual, like, rapes and murders, and so that's really not fun. But in an interview with the Sunday News this week, Corday Park Councillor Colette Ndolovo said residents were living in fear as goblins were continually attacking them, particularly those living in this one neighborhood. We met during the weekend and discussed the issue. People expressed concern and pleaded for an immediate solution because there are serious attacks going on.
By the way, real quick, pause on this. Let's go from the theoretical, obviously this is an actual tragedy happening somewhere else. But why don't the three of us form an actual criminal gang wearing biker jackets and everything, but we call ourselves the Goblins? And then that way, no matter how heinous the crime we commit, we rob a bank, we blow up the vault, we steal all the money. How ridiculous are they going to look when they're like, a bunch of goblins came in here and stole all our money? But then meanwhile, it'll be humans, but they'll call us goblins because we'll have goblins written on all our clothes. No. Well,
apparently, that will work in every other continent on the planet except for Africa, where they take goblin crime very seriously. A prophet has requested every household in the community contribute at least $5 so they can pay for a solution. $400 is needed to stop this threat in its tracks.
Wow. Okay, is there any details on how they plan to stop this goblin?
No.
What?
And by the way, goblin, they're not just mispronouncing Gary, are they? Like, there's one dude named Gary that everyone just calls Goblin, and they're like, we got a real problem with Goblin. Old Goblin Gary, he's a real problem.
No, I believe, I mean, him, Gary, you know, there's never that Gary, you're right, he's a real troublemaker, but there's no sense that it's just a colloquialism.
Huh.
Wow.
All right. Well, should we raise money to fight this goblin?
Should we send them?
I don't know. I mean, maybe we can. I don't know. I mean,
well, this article
says
there's
no good guys in this scenario, right?
Yeah. This article says that here's what the goblins they say have done: throwing stones at houses and breaking windows.
Okay, those are children. Those are children.
Some also claim to have been attacked while walking during the night, but stones and windows.
So $400, what unlisted here was that they were apparently also catching the Boogaloo flu as they were breakdancing in the town square.
I believe it.
So, more goblin news. Goblin news out here for y'all.
Okay, so let's play something. Since normally we have Andrew Main here, who has already read all the stories in This Week in Science, and of course, if you guys are subscribers to the Weird List, Andrew's been super active this whole week, sending out good stuff to the Weird List. We have some hype machine happening about another SpaceX announcement. What do we know about that so far, Justin?
So far, here's what we know. Some dude alleges to have seen the details on an upcoming SpaceX announcement, and he has said it is monumental. Many have speculated that this is the prelude to some real timeline serious plans by SpaceX to fly to Mars. Now, Elon Musk has had himself a very busy week getting caught up in the tech press. Hype loop of he dared to say some negative things about Apple because they're hiring a lot of Tesla engineers. And so he had to spent one day giving an interview in, a translated interview, because I think it was with a German publication. And then the rest of the week saying, no, for real, I really like Apple. It's just, whatever. Get out of my face. I'm Elon Musk. But also made the point that we need to leave Earth as soon as possible, which would certainly be, I mean, it's stuff he's said before, but would also tend to lead to the idea that SpaceX is going to make a forthcoming announcement.
So I guess as long as we're talking about stuff posted out on Twitter and whatnot, and of course, because Andrew's not here to defend himself, Andrew and I had a fairly fundamental disagreement over a rumor going around that I thought was fairly well-founded. Andrew thought was total hogwash. And I kind of want to go to you as our mediator. In fact, both you and Bryce. So there was an article that suggested that that Elon Musk is secretly building an entire fleet of completely autonomous vehicles. And his evidence was, take a look at the Model X. The Model X has doors that open on their own, both front doors and back doors. It's got refueling stations that you pull up and a snake-like arm takes a plug and it finds the plug and plugs in completely on its own. And that technically everything about the Model X could theoretically, with a couple of software upgrades, suddenly be a completely autonomous vehicle. And basically the point of the article was it's clear he's building his own driverless Uber service where you won't need to park cars anywhere. They can just travel around on their own and recharge on their own and show up. And the other bit of information that he put in there is that Elon Musk in his presentation bragged about the storage space underneath the seats in front of you. So you can get into the back seat, you can stow items in front of you, kind of like you would on a commercial aircraft, and then get taken to your destination in style. I thought all of this was right on the money, but it seemed like Andrew didn't believe that. Like, where do you guys come down on this rumor?
Well, all right, hold on. I think what you guys got into, from what I saw of the back and forth, the contention was that, and this is the thing that started it, fair bet that Tesla will start the first self-driving taxi service. And I think what Andrew's point was that they don't need to start the taxi service because
they have, you know, the vehicles.
Ford doesn't need to be Uber. Ford sells Ford cars to people that then drive it for Uber, and that Tesla will not run the taxi service, although many self-driving taxi services that pop up might run on Tesla, and Tesla will build the backbone for it and supply the fleet for it.
Yeah, that seems reasonable.
That's what his point was, as I could summarize it, and it makes sense based on other conversations I've had with him.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot more sense. So it sounds like we're all in agreement, and I want to open it up to you and Bryce, Justin. I mean, you feel like it's fairly clear that all of Tesla is being designed to be part of an autonomous fleet in the future, right?
Definitely. I mean, they just announced that this week the autopilot feature for some of their Tesla models would be going out via an OTA update. So some people will wake up on Thursday and their car will be able to do some of the driving for them. I think it's just highway driving, but I mean, you know,
dude, that's all that matters, man. Enough. If I can get to Dallas and play Hearthstone the whole way, I'm done. I'm in. I'll buy it.
I think that will probably still be unsafe. Like, even in the Tesla model, I think playing Hearthstone while you're driving probably still unsafe.
Like, however, what are you supposed to do while the car's driving for you on the highway? Just stare intently, judgmentally at the car?
Now, in the tomorrow, let's say you run out and buy a Model X, or, you know, a Model X gets delivered to you. I don't think you'd be able to do it today. However, yes, in the future, that is the bright, beautiful, shining dream that we can all hope to one day live in. It makes sense for Tesla to do it. There's no reason why it would fit with the very aggressive mindset that Tesla has. And because they were linked, you know, so much today in the press, or this week in the press, it fits with where Apple was probably about 5-10 years ago, where they found themselves with about a 3-year head start. In a, you know, 3 to 5 year head start, especially in mobile computing with iOS, and they were very, you know, intent to build up that lead as far as they can, with the idea being that as soon as other people realize that this is the future, that gap will narrow because people will put money and brain power behind solving it. And I think that feels like where Tesla is. There are a lot of other people that are doing a lot of interesting work in it. And funny enough, in that scenario, Tesla is Apple with iOS and the iPhone, and Apple itself is almost playing the role of Google and Android, you know, and that, not to say that they're far different in their philosophies, but they are similar in that Google realized, oh, wait, oh, my God, mobile is the future, when they saw, you know, a year into the iPhone being a thing, and said, yep, everything that we have going, scrap it. Here's where we go. Apple now, if the EV rumors are true, for which, you know, I joked on Tech Daily Tech News Show that, you know, it's kind of the Bigfoot of Bay Area rumors. You know, like everybody knows somebody that's seen something or has a cousin that's working on it or knows somebody that is, you know, in the loop on it. So it seems likely that that's where it's going. But I think it's Apple's idea of, hey, cars might be something radically different in the future. And maybe Apple wants to sell to those companies that sell to the Ubers of the world, sell to autonomous taxi services, sell to personal, you know, people who, or to private customers who just want to own an autonomous car.
Can
and
we?
That's an interesting parallel between Apple and Uber, or sorry, Apple and Tesla, because Tesla is keeping the product line small, but there's still a lot of room for Tesla to go in many different directions, including creating custom cars or custom fleet style cars. You know, it's not unthinkable that Tesla would say, here is a car that nobody will drive. It is just passenger seats or something. Like, that's something that Tesla over a more traditional manufacturer like a Ford or Chevy is positioned to do, because they're so technology and software heavy.
So let me kick this out to you guys. Let's speculate wildly, and some people believe this will happen in 10 years. Some believe that we're 40 or 50 years off. But let's say we hit that soft middle area where there are two forces at work in your heart. Now, all three of us, you know, and Andrew Main, of course, all born in America, you know, and America has this very frontier mentality. You own your own pickup truck, you drive around, you take care of your car, you change the oil. This is your vehicle. This is your ticket to the rest of the world. And yet we are looking at a very real possibility where the very idea of personal car ownership is how ubiquitous does the ability to autonomously summon a vehicle need to be, where all of a sudden it overrides this instinctual, you know, 20, 30, 40 year sales pressure that you are identified by your car that you own, that it gets overshadowed? And I'm speaking about
That's a very tricky question, though, because we have a car culture identity in America, because we have very different uses for cars. A rural use for a vehicle is nowhere near the same as my use for a vehicle, or even you guys in Austin, which is alternately, you know, if you just live in the Austin city center, then yeah, right now you can probably get around with only screwing around with Ubers, and you just got to worry about getting outside the city here and again to go do stuff. Whereas, you know, Brian, you live in the suburbs, so having a vehicle is very, very, very important.
And not only that, the times that are the most important for me to be able to summon a vehicle are usually at, you know, 4 a.m. when I have to go make it to a 6 a.m. flight, and I need to be able to lug 200 pounds of trunks and four carry-ons and a second person with me.
You really can't call an Uber to be a pickup truck.
To hitch
a U-Haul.
Right. Well, and it's one of those things where it's like, you can, let's say Uber was able to do that, 9 times out of 10, it only takes that 1 time out of 10 that I miss my flight because I couldn't get the Uber at the time that I needed it, even though I was promised it, for me to totally not be willing to make that leap. So, I mean, considering those moments, and you travel a lot as well, Justin, but you have a lot of different options, and you very rarely have to take large amounts of equipment, right?
No, I very often. I mean, I'm traveling with two large suitcases. It's not the four, you know, trunks that you've normally traveled with.
Does it cause you to like for example, do you keep the gear in the car ready to go at any time, or do you get? I know that I personally get anxious when my show is not loaded in the car, or when anybody implies that that there's a, you know, you could just take a shuttle or someone will pick you up or any of that stuff just makes me nervous because I don't know if they're going to show up in time. I don't know if there's going to be room for whatever my stuff is.
Oh, yeah. No, I rent a car. I mean, I normally, even Ubers, you know, it's car rental is actually fairly cheap these days. And you know, you can normally get a car, even if it's for a day trip, for the about the price that you would pay to get in a cab ride to and from your hotel, you know, especially if you're not staying in one with a shuttle or something like that. But in general, I prefer to just have a car. But again, I think that when we talk about the autonomous driving thing, I think what is for sure is the relic will be us hitting pedals. Us hitting pedals will go away.
Oh,
the
absolutely.
Idea of whether or not we are all in some hive mind subscription service where it's like, Cartron, a car for me, please. I'm going from here to here. And it says, beep, bop, boop, of course. Like, whether it's that or you just have your own self-driving pickup truck that is effectively just a more agile, interesting, energy efficient version of a traditional car now, I think is as diverse as all of our needs for cars as they exist.
So I guess what comes first, or maybe this is obvious, but self-driving vehicles becoming the norm will come before the dilution of a car culture of owning a car. I mean, does that sound?
I think, well, number one, we've already seen the dilution of car culture. Like the idea that with Uber and Lyft, it's now feasible to live in major cities without a car that don't have good public transportation is huge. You know, because if you look at cities like Houston, you know, Houston or Dallas or something like that, these are gigantic population structures that have fairly poopy public transportation.
Well, and let's say it's great public transportation. It's not the fault of the transportation itself. It's the fact that it's just defeated by the size of the Metroplex. You can't reach all of the tendrils out there. You know, you could drive, you know, 15 minutes to a main artery and then take light rail downtown and then be stuck in downtown or whatever. But it's like this stuff is so spread out that it's just built into the culture that you need to be able to have your own vehicle to get anywhere.
But what if
but now. Now you have that ability. Like you can live, depending on where you work, you can live in Dallas and not own a car. That's insane. Like that is a possibility now. That if you factor in gas and insurance and everything, that it's not crazy to think that with the right routes, especially if you can get to and from work fairly easily, that's not a thing. So we are already seeing a dissolution of it. I think the next step is going to be as what Tesla is doing, where you see soft autonomy, the idea that you could now cruise control is just mega cruise control, you know, cruise control S+. Now you're going to see legal challenges to how legal that is. You're going to see Austin man arrested for playing Hearthstone on the highway to Dallas.
Hey, by the way, dude,
what else am I supposed to do while my car is driving for me? Says area man, father of three. And now that those arguments will be played out legally, and that's where you start to see gigantic shifts start.
Well, and this is a perfect segue because this week, 4 days ago, Mashable.com has an article titled "Volvo Accepts Full Liability for its cars in autonomous mode." In a speech scheduled for Thursday night at the House of Sweden in Washington, D.C., that's an odd sentence. President and Chief Executive of Volvo Cars, Håkan Samuelsson, will state that his company will, quote, accept full liability whenever one of its cars is in autonomous mode, which to me, number one, Volvo's got the brand in order to lead the way on that. Number two, this is the key that is going to make it possible for us to trust cars. Like once somebody puts their money where their mouth is and says, we accept responsibility for how these cars perform, which they will and they should, because, you know, again, we're looking at 30,000 people a year die in the United States from car accidents. That is 15 9/11s every single year. That's more than a 9/11 every month that we just, you know, shrug our shoulders and be like, oh, okay. It's like, tell me, if you're a company, that's a safe bet. Once you get robots in control, let's say it goes down to 500, and yes, those 500 are each tragedies, and they're each horrific, and you don't like paying out $1 million to $2 million per claim every year. Meanwhile, you're saving 15 9/11s every year.
I mean, listen, it's a great point, and if there's one thing we've learned over the last month is that when a European car company makes a promise, you can trust it.
I think that it seems to me like this is a very big step in the right direction, because it's one thing for us to all see, look at this, somebody's playing Hearthstone right now on this
no, animated. They're looking at business papers and everything. It's like, oh, look, they're looking at business Hearthstone.
She's watching business Netflix right now.
She's so stressed, though, looking at she seems like she's way tense.
She's just
about
really
it,
excited about this episode of Breaking Bad. She's finally caught up, and Heisenberg has really accepted his entire position. Dude, I'm telling you, it's a smart move for the companies to go public. It's a smart move for the companies to accept responsibility for some of the horrific things that will happen. And it's a safe bet for society to get on board with this. Quit driving your cars, idiots. You're killing people.
Now, okay. Is that,
All right. You just take a cold shower. You get so worked up about the autonomous cars, Brian.
Look,
so
I just want to be able to have like 12 beers and then know the car will get me home safe.
So one last question I guess I have about this is we're kind of working on the assumption that the mass market version of this is either an Uber-like service where you can call a car or you own an autonomous car. But I wonder if there is not if there aren't throughways to expand public transportation. I mean, we talked about it earlier that the issue with public transportation is that it doesn't go everywhere, and the services depends on where you're at. But what if autonomous vehicles can expand the services of public transportation and the coverage area? Does that eat into your own personal autonomous vehicle or your own ride-sharing solution?
I'm going to make the prediction that once I think that a fleet of robotically controlled autonomous vehicles will be so efficient, so carbon efficient, because they'll all be running on electricity before you know it. Essentially, think of the city as a living organism, and the we are the oxygen being transported in and out of the city by these red corpuscles, these electric robot-driven cars. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be so efficient and so useful that we're going to see the dismantling. We're going to see tearing up the real estate of light rail for being so stupid and inefficient and so slow. And I think they're just going to build more highways.
But is that personal auto service enough to stem rush hour? I think that's the big thing where rush hour is such a surge of everybody needing to be on the road at once that there's a need for a mass transit solution.
You already see some of that with the use of Waze. One of the things that Waze does, W-A-Z-E, is especially in Los Angeles, it keeps you off of all the main arteries. It figures out all the underused bandwidth.
Yeah, no, if you have ever wanted to feel like Jack Bauer, use Waze directions in Los Angeles, because all you are doing is just making constant lefts and rights onto LA side streets. You know, just opening it, like maybe just me. I'm just opening it up to. I'm doing highway speeds in residential areas.
Sure.
Constantly.
Well, and think about what else happens in that world. Once, and not that it's all run by one global system, but instead, like if a computer is scheduling out when to maximize bandwidth on all of our America's highways, then it would do things like, for example, take 18-wheelers. It would say, all of you guys, don't even try to drive between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. Don't even try to drive between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. Instead, wait until the off hours. And when you do drive, you guys just sleep. And we're going to line up 37 of you in a row with a gap of exactly 8 feet between all of you so that it slipstreams. You're going to get a 39% increase in efficiency. You're all going to move as a train at night when all of this is not very used. And don't worry if there's any other cars on the road, where, you know, we'll put the word out for them so they'll make sure to stay out of the 100 mile an hour lane on there.
But the only thought about that is we're talking about a world where this has hit critical mass, right?
Like, and that we're a centralized system.
Nope. It's not centralized.
I know it's Brian. I mean, it doesn't have to be centralized because a lot of these technologies are being built on the idea that you are reacting to everything. And so as long as everybody's operating on the same principles, that it should move more efficiently once you have critical mass adoption, more than, you know, I'm checking my text and, you know, Brian's, you know, thinking about playing Hearthstone and not actually doing it.
Yeah. He may
dropping
be considering
a chicken sandwich in his lap, like, you know, and everybody's just paying varying degrees of attention to what they're doing. So, I mean, I think but what you're saying, Bryce, is I think legitimate. Like that, I think it's folly for us to announce exactly how the transportation solution is going to be.
Because I feel like the expansion of ride sharing and autonomous vehicles is actually going to push more people to realize that a park and go solution or centralized transit spots will also be a viable option for them with huge people.
I mean,
movers.
But I think park and go, I think is something that will be an antiquated idea because all of these, what we do gain with autonomous driving is more door to door. Like you are not doing autonomous driving so you can get dropped off at a bus depot because buses do that fairly well now. You are taking an autonomous drive because you can put four people that, you know, the app already, like Uber already does, Lyft already does with ride shares, with like Uber Pool and stuff like that, is you're listing where you're going and where you're getting picked up from. And it picks out like, okay, well, all these people are going in the same direction. So beep, bop, beep, bop, bop. You pick all of them up and everybody gets dropped off at their house. I think that is an advantage of an autonomous driver solution, even before we're able to just sort of deal with, you know, everybody on the planet having an autonomous car and creating massive, amazing slipstreams.
I mean, the biggest things, look where our biggest amounts of waste are. We waste having so much hardware sitting in parking lots and garages at any given time, right? And that's all stuff. That's 30% of the real estate of any downtown is wasted on cars sitting there doing nothing. All of that goes away. All of a sudden, you're able to build more structures and your car is working for you and earning you money back. Let's say you own the car, you lease it out to Tesla's service and it runs around as an Uber, and maybe at the end of the day you got a scratch or two, but meanwhile you made an extra, you know, $70 for doing nothing but having owned this
although
vehicle.
imagine the awkward phase we're going to go through where, you know, that's the one thing about the tragedy of the commons: when something is not yours, you have a tendency to do vile, terrible things in those vehicles in a way that you would not do it to your own, and hopefully technology catches up to the point where it realizes through acidity and temperature gauges that somebody booted in the back of this cab before it picks you up for your 4 a.m.
Sure,
you know, flight out of AUS.
Invest in Scotch Guard, people.
Exactly. Tondagasa suggests that stank detection comes standard on all autonomous vehicles.
Oh my gosh. Hey man, do you guys want to shift over and talk about picks for a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah.
You want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first. I got something I'm really excited about. It's really a pick that I've had before, but it's in a brand new format. If you head on over to audible.com for a limited time, you could get a complete audio production of a graphic novel. Now, that sounds a little bit weird. And an audio production of a graphic novel sounds dumb. That sounds as dumb as trying to make some kind of audio production of a movie, which is exactly what the Star Wars radio drama was. And this is just a different flavor of the same thing. I'm talking about Lock and Key, L-O-C-K-E and K-E-Y, is one of my favorite graphic novels of all time. And I keep pushing Justin to finish it because I think Justin said he gave up because it felt like it was just going to be this forever. But it actually has a beginning, a middle, and end. And they've apparently it had a bit of a journey as it almost became a movie. It was almost a television show, almost a miniseries, almost these other things. And I guess at some point they were like, screw it. Let's make it a really delightful audio play. You've got big names. You got Tatiana, what's her name, from Orphan Black. You got the chick who played Captain Janeway, Red and Orange is the New Black. You've got Haley Joel Osment does a fantastic job playing the main character, Tyler. I got to tell you, now understand, I am experiencing this having already read the graphic novel, so I enjoy it just like I enjoyed the radio drama for Star Wars. I cannot imagine what it's like to watch or to listen to the Star Wars radio drama having never seen the movie. And you know, but maybe you could tell me. Maybe you guys can experience for free the Lock and Key audio story and tell me how good it is when you only hear the story and you don't see the gorgeous visuals.
Hmm. A star-studded cast of big names. That one lady, the other guy, what's her butt?
And bunch Haley of people from UCB. I should point out that I was talking on Twitter about how excited I was about it. And then, man, Twitter really does remind you that it's a two-way street because somebody hit me up like, oh, are you excited about it? And I was like, yeah, I'm enjoying it so far, I guess. They're like, yeah, we made that. And I was like, oh, hi, guys.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Good thing I said I liked it. A bad form by them. You need to come in with the like, hey, we made it. Thanks for doing it. Just so you're not like, yeah, I know. It's great except for the crappy UCB actors. Am I right? Elbow.
That's not how it happened. It was, in fact, I said.
I know. But that's, I mean, come on.
I do want to explain that what I said was like, oh, man, I just have this weird compulsion to try to figure out who's who playing who. And their answer was like, yeah, pretty much everyone's in UCB.
That's funny. Yeah, and by the way, I did not stop reading it because I thought everything was going to be the same. I hit a roadblock with a decision they made story wise, where I felt it kind of took the air out of some of their consequences. Which it is a worthwhile story for what I read because they do such a great job of building up tension, and then I hit a point in which I felt there should have been consequences for actions, and instead there were. Like
stuff felt
no
a bit rubbery
for those actions.
Yeah, I can understand.
That bothered me, and I stopped reading it. But anyway, certainly worthwhile. I got an old movie. So I started watching it on the Netflix. Kingpin.
Oh my God! The comedy with Bill Murray and Woody Harrelson.
And the currently embroiled in controversy Randy Quaid, back in his salad days. So Kingpin is I think the best script that the Farrelly brothers did. The Farrelly brothers did, of course, Dumb and Dumber. There's Something About Mary, most notably. This was before Something About Mary. So it was before they kind of went into that rare air of like mega blockbuster R-rated comedies, which really only happened like once every 15 years. It's really what made them super worthwhile at that period where they were doing those films, because they're always good. And even now they're good with slapstick. Like they have this like Looney Tunes kind of sensibility to it. But Kingpin is a great script when you look at it for like these themes of disability and all the characters on some level are missing something except for the villain. Which is played by Bill Murray, who has it all and is terrible. But you have all of these characters that are, just kind of put upon by society for various reasons, and it's kind of an exceptional script. And I forgot how good the writing is, and it's easy to have it glossed over when it's interspersed with gags like. Woody Harrelson's character, who has a rubber hand throughout the movie, has it comically flown off his stump and lands on a woman's breast while she's making out with somebody. So he, Bugs Bunny style, removes the rubber hand and replaces the guy's hand on her boob, which is like, about as like slapstick sophomoric as you can get. But in the midst, there's some really, really clever and fun and heartfelt writing in there. And I very much enjoyed rewatching it. And man, 90s Vanessa Angel. Hachi Machi.
Hachi Machi? Is that the what the kids are saying?
Oh, geez, Louise, covered in cheese.
Geez, Louise, covered in cheese. She's Hachi Machi.
So I have a pick for you guys this week.
Yeah.
I've been talking about this a little bit online. I know, Brian, you've played the Stanley Parable.
Yes, enjoyed it very much. I played it several times.
Do you know about the Stanley Parable, Justin?
I am aware of it. I'm more aware of the soundtrack since it's been played so many times on the Night Attack show. But that's pretty much the extent.
So the short pitch on Stanley Parable is that it uses a really good understanding of how people play video games to teach some interesting – to raise some interesting questions about what the role of the person behind the keyboard is. Not just the role of the video game in this conversation between the two of you, including a very war games like idea that, you know, it's actually all right to like the best option many times in the scenario posed by a video game is to not play it, that playing it is actually harmful to the non-playable characters. But the creator of that, Davy Wren, has a new game out called The Beginner's Guide. And the conceit of The Beginner's Guide is that it is Wren himself showing you a curation of games by a programmer named Coda from 2008 to 2011. And the conceit of the game is that he is narrating you playing through these different levels and showing you how Coda's voice evolves from starting off just taking like a Counter-Strike map, just taking D-Dust and putting extra boxes in it and just kind of throwing stuff around into these longer, more complicated programs, many of which have hidden and obfuscated goals. And as Wren is narrating these experiences and giving his own perspective, he is also modifying the game so that these experiences that would otherwise be hard to sell on to anybody makes it palatable. So there's an example where you walk into a prison cell and the door shuts and the door only opens after you wait one full hour.
Oh my God.
And you wouldn't, so nobody would be able to play that, or nobody would sit through that, generally speaking. So I don't want to say too much more about it because it has its own narrative twists, but I would say that if you are listening to this and you want an interesting, if you want, I think my gameplay was interrupted when I played it.
Okay,
it's only about 2 hours long.
Is it better to experience all straight through?
I would say it's best to take two breaks.
Okay,
there's a game that's called This Game Is Connected to the Internet.
Yeah,
I'd say when that game starts, you take a break and just think about the game. Think about what you think it's going to tell you, what you think you know about Coda and Davy, and then go back and play. And then there's another level where you are sort of on a snowy mountaintop, and there's a home. You spend some time in the home. At the end of that level, you stop, do the same thing. Just take enough time to think, have an idea of what you think the game is, because once you get to the end of the story, your thoughts will inform your own take on it.
Okay. All right.
That's as much as I want to say.
I want to go in as blind as I can. Maybe I'll actually start that tonight as soon as we finish with Weird Things because I've been promising people that I'd do that.
And it really is. It's only 2 hours long. I think it's $10 on Steam, and you can play it on Windows, Mac, and via Steam Play, which I think is
I'll play it. I'll play it.
Okay. So that's that.
Wow, man. It's already been an hour and 20. That was fast.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, what do you need an Andrew Main for when you outside got all these hot takes?
Outside of, like, fact-checking and
knowing things.
Important analysis and, like, sensibility. Sure. Yeah, forget that guy.
I know. No, what everybody doesn't see is that right next to me, I have a bale of hay with a SpaceX hat on it that we are pretending is Andrew Bain, and he has knowingly watched over this podcast in spirit.
Amazing.
All right. Well, that's it, folks. Until next time, I'm Justin. That's Brian. That's Bryce. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.